Hello, and welcome to Episode 8 of Strong Style History here at Place to Be Nation and the Pro Wrestling Only Boards podcast feed. My name is Jeffrey Wessel. I am the host and blogger of Strong Style Story, which you can also listen to here on Place to Be Nation and the Pro Wrestling Only Board podcast feed. You can follow the blog at strongstylestory.tumblr.com, and you can find me on Twitter at strongstylestory without the E in style on Twitter. With me today is my co-host and producer, Chris Damasceno.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
On the most recent episode of Strong Style Story, we discussed the upcoming King of Pro Wrestling card that's due to happen on October the 9th at Tokyo Ryogoku Kokugikan. Today, here on Strong Style History, however, we're going to discuss the original King of Pro Wrestling card from 2012, on October the 8th, from Tokyo Ryogoku Kokugikan. This was a show that had about 9,000 people reported attendance, and the full title of it was 40th Anniversary King of Pro Wrestling, as this was, you know, during 2012, which was the 40th anniversary year of New Japan, much as this year is the 45th anniversary of New Japan. The roots of this show go back to January of 2012, when New Japan was purchased by collectible card gaming company Bushiroad from Yuke's, who were the video game manufacturers. And they instituted this particular show as a tie-in to Bushiroad's own King of Pro Wrestling collectible card game. Now, prior to this, Destruction was the October event, but that has since been pushed to September, which, as if you keep up with New Japan, you know, we just ended the Destruction cycle of shows because now they split them up into two or three different shows. King of Pro Wrestling always happens on the second Monday in October because that is a holiday known as Health and Sports Day in Japan. So that they always run on that show. And other pro wrestling companies tend to run during that time, too. And in addition, one of the main significances of King of Pro Wrestling 2012 was this was the first time that a New Japan pay-per-view event was available outside of Japan. They streamed this via the old Ustream service, you know, back in the days before NJPW World was a thing.
God, Ustream being a thing way back when, that's, even now it's still somewhat of a thing for certain events and things like that, but back then it was almost unprecedented at the fact that you'd be able to get a New Japan show kind of streamed in person outside of the U.S. unless you
procured
it accordingly, so.
Yeah, that was a big thing. I mean, it was a big thing. Now, I did not buy it at the time, I have to confess. I had to wait later, because... Mm-hmm. Of circumstances, but yeah, I mean, that was a thing, is that this was the first time a live New Japan event could be seen outside of Japan. That was huge.
Very big news.
And yeah, I mean, that alone, you know, was a seismic shift in, you know, in the way that New Japan did business. So, but overall, it was a nine match show. We're going to go through eight out of the nine matches. We'll explain why here in a few minutes. The show began with a bit of a significant event happening here. The team of Yuji Nagata, Manabu Nakanishi, and Strongman, who was also known as John Anderson, a former bodybuilder, strongman, and wrestler who had previously worked in California and CMLL and even did a few Inoki Genome Federation events prior to going to New Japan. He and Nakanishi at the time were a team known as Muscle Orchestra. However, this match in October of 2012 was Nakanishi's first match since a back injury that he suffered in June of 2011.
So, the crowd was pretty happy to see him throughout the entire match. Like,
Right.
They were excited for his spots.
And it didn't hurt who they were facing in this match, which was a chaos team of Toriano, Takashi Iizuka, and Tomohiro Ishii. Now, we have discussed Takashi Iizuka. Actually, we discussed Takashi Iizuka at length in the previous episode of Strong Style History, but that was back when he was still a younger guy and still a bit of a shooter back then. Now we're into crazy Iizuka with, you know, the shaven head and the long goatee and the iron finger from hell.
Yep.
And but this is when he was still in Chaos.
And this is a time that, by the way, guys, Chaos was a legitimately full heel faction with the New Japan.
Yes, this is back when they, I mean, yeah, the crowd absolutely despised this group. And it was something that newer viewers would not probably get used to at this point. I just want to take another minute to talk about Strongman, because when you watch him, and his mannerisms and how he looks and acts, he looks like kind of like the missing link between Goldberg and Brian Cage.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at him,
The way I described it in my notes for the match, just because I wasn't all that impressed, given that I haven't seen much of him, but seeing one of these matches, I'm just like, I kind of actually wrote in my notes, was New Japan searching for the bottom of the barrel for decent big / strong gaijins at the time?
Oh my goodness.
Because, I mean, at the time, don't get me wrong, they had Carl Anderson killing it in singles and things like that. They had, I think Tama Tonga was running around here and there and things like that. But out of the kind of big strong gaijins that Japan seems to like, Strongman seems to be scratching the bottom of that barrel compared to some of the names they've had in the past and present.
Yeah, but I mean, he wasn't hated, though. I mean,
he wasn't.
I mean, teaming with Nakanishi only helped for him. Mm-hmm. Some of the other things I want to point out that seem unreal now. First of all, Toriano actually kind of sort of looked like he was attempting to actually wrestle a little bit, slightly, in this match.
Those were fun times.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, those were fun times. And just as an extra note, he took a gnarly German suplex near the end of the match from Nakanishi there.
He did. And I want to say that, is that this was Nakanishi's first match since that back injury, you know, that took him out for like a year and a half. And yet one of the first things he does is a double suplex on Toriano and Takashi Iizuka.
I bet
that helped his back.
It's like, I'm okay, guys, honest. My back doesn't hurt anymore.
Well, one thing, here's the biggest thing that stood out to me on this match was that, you know, nowadays when you watch modern New Japan and the attitudes towards Tomohiro Ishii, that he's like this big dog, big hoss wrestler. Every time we think he's going in, it's going to be a hoss fight. And yet he was getting completely washed in this match.
Yeah, you've got to remember, because this is just the year before Ishii legitimately broke out during the G1. For the most part, he was the guy in Chaos that was taking all of these falls during these multi-man tag matches during the entirety of 2012.
Right. I think he was still more or less considered a junior, if not in actuality, then in practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just crazy seeing that now. You know, the contrast between there. In the end, though, it was the Chaos faction who defeated Nagata and Muscle Orchestra when Yano rolled up the returning Nakanishi after Nakanishi got hit with the Iron Finger from Hell.
Yeah, it was like a low blow, I believe, the referee distraction, and then the Iron Finger from Hell immediately after falling into the roll-up and whatnot. So, there was chicanery.
It was chicanery. It was there was a bunch of cheating going on, but you know it wasn't bad. I mean, you know, it was what it was. It was Nakanishi coming back in an opening tag match. You know,
which started the show off strong. And I mean, between obviously Nakanishi getting good reactions, the crowd just exploding for Nagata as he just started to kick everybody in sight was always.
Oh yeah, I mean yeah, the crowd was all over Nagata too. So I mean, yeah, this was a fun match. I mean, it was a fun match. It's just odd seeing, you know, like I said, the trifecta of Iizuka still being in Chaos, Yano actually kind of, sort of, maybe looking like he was attempting to actually wrestle, and then Ishii just getting washed. Mm-hmm. It just jars with, you know, how things are now. Just, you know, a testament to how things can change within, you know, 5 years in New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah, definitely so.
So the second match of the card is the one that we're not going to talk about because we can't seem to find video of this match. It was not on New Japan World, and I checked sources and couldn't locate it. I found other matches with these two teams, but I couldn't find this particular one.
Yeah.
It was Forever Hooligans, the old junior heavyweight tag tandem of Rocky Romero and Alex Kozlov.
What a great theme song.
They had a great theme song. They defeated Time Splitters, who were Kushida and Alex Shelley, mm-hmm. to retain the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Team belts. I do remember this as being a pretty good match.
Yeah.
But again, having not being able to go back and watch it, I can't really testify.
Yeah. If anybody out there, once you listen to this episode and you know the reason why that match didn't make New Japan World in this case, please let us know, because we're as curious as anybody about it right now.
Yeah, it just seemed odd. It just seemed odd to me, so that it's not on there. And I thought, I mean, unless it's like, you know, like with Naoya Ogawa, where he has like a copyright claim on there, I don't think Alex Kozlov has any such thing like that going on, I don't think. But whatever the case, here we are, and we couldn't watch this match. So whatever the case, it was Forever Hooligans did retain against Time Splitters, mm-hmm. still holding the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag belts. The third match on the show was Kota Ibushi, who was still then considered a DDT wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
He had not yet signed the dual contract between DDT and New Japan. So he was still a DDT wrestler. And I believe that was a young Shigehiro Irie seconding him. I thought I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not often you have like a kind of a, you know, chunkier fellow with a mohawk. You know, there seem to be a few of those in Japan these days, like with, you know, Dinosaur Takuma in K-Dojo, but I believe that was a younger Shigehiro Irie acting as a, you see him kind of acting like a DDT young lion, because he was there wearing a black DDT t-shirt.
A second, basically.
As a second, yeah. He worked to defend the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title against Low Ki.
Ugh.
Now, I know whatever your personal opinion of Low Ki is, the fact is he's still a pretty damn good wrestler, and this was a pretty damn good match.
Oh yeah, absolutely agreed on that. It's one of those things where Low Ki is like that guy with so much talent, but one of the shittiest attitudes you could possibly have in pro wrestling, which does not help him.
And we all know that he burns pretty much every bridge he ever comes across,
I think even under sarcasm, one of the other notes I had when observing like the opening of the match, I'm like, well, at least he isn't wearing a hitman suit for this one.
Yeah, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know that's his shtick nowadays is wearing a suit. But in any event, Low Ki would end up besting Ibushi with a top rope key crusher,
which did look very, very gnarly altogether. That Ibushi would agree to do. Because
Ibushi is insane, is certifiable. But in any event, so Low Ki winning his third IWGP Junior Heavyweight title reign. Following the match, Low Ki was, of course, challenged by who was then considered the junior ace, Prince Devitt.
Yep, with the little mic performance and everything else, and of course, keep in mind, we're still in 2012. We're still...
Oh, yes. We're several months away from an event that we'll talk about. So yep. we're several months away from a certain thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth match on the show, Tenkoji, Hiroshi Tenzan, and Satoshi Kojima defending the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team titles against the Killer Elite squad of Suzuki Gun, Lance Archer and Davey Boy Smith Jr. They were also seconded by Taka Michinoku.
Yeah. And interesting fact at that point is that at that time, Suzuki Gun was about the 1 year mark since they'd betrayed Kojima and turned with Minoru becoming the boss of the entire faction. Right. So there's history there, obviously.
Yes, there was. And yeah, they were Kojima Gun. Mm-hmm. And then they, all betrayed. Yeah, Satoshi Kojima just doesn't have good luck with units because.
Always gets turned on.
Yeah, he gets turned on pretty well, any unit that he starts. The Killer Elite squad ended up defeating Tenkoji with Smith pinning Kojima following dual killer bombs, one to Tenzan and then one to Kojima.
And as an extra note on that, out of the entire year of existence that Suzuki Gun had up to that point, that was their first title win ever for that stable.
Yeah, that is true. They had not won any titles up until that point. So yeah, they finally kind of legitimized themselves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
With that match. I mean, overall, that match was okay. I've seen better matches with these teams. Mm-hmm. But I think this was okay. It was an okay match. It was it was basically a typical heavyweight tag title match in New Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, even then.
Granted, even then, Kojima and Tenzan were kind of limited in what they were doing compared to years of their prime. But still, 5 years early, they were still doing some fairly good things on it. And yeah, it was an okay heavyweight tag title match. So. Enjoy for what it is, right?
Indeed, indeed. The fifth match was kind of a bunch of nothing. Yujiro Takahashi defeated his former No Limit partner, Tetsuya Naito.
And let's talk about Naito for a moment and the fact that between 2017 Naito and looking back at 2012 Naito, it's night and day, because the Polvo de Estrella, Stardust Genius, Please Love Me Naito was just like, it seems like it's light years away at this point. It's
crazy. But we have to keep in context too that Naito, he was doing the Please Love Me shtick and it was working because he was beloved at this point. Mm-hmm. However, the whole point of this match was mostly to write Naito out for a while, because you could see in the match he had his knee taped up, and he was going away for surgery.
Yeah, he wrecked his knee during the G1 that year, if I recall correctly, and still kind of wrestled through it, but then at a certain point they told him, yeah, you gotta get surgery on it, so this was the match that they used to write it off, which I thought, writing-wise, was brilliant in the fact that it made Yujiro look like a real bastard, coming after the knee after the top rope spot that they did with Naito basically just starting the favorite. And
oh yeah. I mean, when you see like Naito flopping like a fish.
Yep.
You're
like, oh yeah, so that's when that happened. Because it took me a moment to realize, I'm like, why is he sounding like this? And then it popped in my head, I'm like, oh yeah, that's when he went away for surgery. And then that the match runtime made a lot more sense.
Yeah, it was. It ended with a referee stop. Now, This is also back when Yujiro Takahashi was in chaos,
mm-hmm.
and had he had a Miami Heat logo on his trunks, which I thought was kind of cute.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had that. Doesn't he have the Miami Shine, which you never see anymore?
Yeah, I think that was around the time that he was still using that fairly often.
Right, and I just want to point out it looked like Astro Boy was on Naito's shirt.
Yeah, I believe it was some sort of Astro Boy Naito like little Cobra. But I mean, New Japan's done this kind of stuff before, so.
They did it not too long ago with everything from Hello Kitty to Kaneko Man.
Yep, the Kaneko Man New Japan shirts are still money in my opinion. Like, some great designs have come out of those.
Oh yeah, those were fantastic. Yeah, I wish I had the Okada one.
Yeah, I need to grab the Okada one at some point. If not that, the Nakamura one was pretty legit as well too, because I think he was the one with the Kevin Mask design off the top of my head.
I think you might be right on that. But anyway, we're getting off topic.
Sorry.
But again, yeah, this was more or less just a way to write Naito off.
It's crazy to think about. This is the beginning of what would lead the current Naito to, which is just...
Sometimes pro wrestling booking can be a really long game, and it's interesting to go back when you see the genesis of it all. I mean, even if it wasn't apparent at the time, and it wasn't planned in any way, but it just when you put all the pieces together that circumstances have allowed, it's amazing what kind of a story you can build from it.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of story, here's a match that is rife with story.
Oh boy, yeah.
The following match was a tag match in which a team known as Always Hypers. This was Togi Makabe and Wataru Inoue. If anybody remembers Wataru Inoue,
that was a name that I had not seen in a while, obviously because of the events that led to his retirement, but.
Yes.
This was a trip to memory lane for sure.
Yeah, this was a trip to memory lane. They took on a team of invaders known as Laughing Seven. This was Kazushi Sakuraba and Katsuyori Shibata.
The shooters are here, ladies and gentlemen.
This was during a period of time when this was the second match that Shibata and Sakuraba had done in New Japan since returning the month before at the Destruction Show. Shibata returning after 6.5 years away. And the last time he had shown up, he was at the Tokyo Dome show in 2006. I believe he faced Tanahashi, if I recall correctly. He faced Hiroshi Tanahashi. But ever since then, he had done freelance work, including teaming with Kenta in Pro Wrestling Noah, and then did MMA for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And his return caused some tumult in the locker room.
Boy. Oh, they were not happy.
They were not happy. A lot of the wrestlers, including Hiroshi Tanahashi and Shinsuke Nakamura especially, had a little bit of PTSD from how things went down in the later years of Antonio Inoki's running of New Japan, leading up to the sale in 2007, and many of the wrestlers were not happy to see Shibata come back, especially because of the bad times, and then also due to the fact that Shibata had essentially turned his back on the company at a time when they needed him.
Mm. There is, and eventually I think that's in that store episode of Strong Style History that we could really touch on, is just the fact of Tana, Nakamura, and Shibata as the kind of newly dubbed, I guess, Three Musketeers at that particular time, and just how deferring all three of these paths ended up going with the environment that they were in New Japan, and how things ended up changing throughout, and kind of where they all fell at this point. So
if you look at, yeah, 5 years is an eternity in pro wrestling, and you can just see the differences between Shibata, how Shibata was treated in 2012 by the crowd, and in 2017, again, night and day. I mean, Shibata and Sakuraba were basically treated as the heel invaders that they were.
Mm-hmm.
This was bittersweet too. The match ending with Shibata hitting Inoue with an assisted penalty kick because Sakuraba had illegally come in and put the sleeper on Inoue.
Yep.
And, a very bittersweet note to this, as Chris already hinted. We were a mere 5 months away from Wataru Inoue suffering the career-ending neck injury.
Mm-hmm.
That he got that on March the 4th of 2013. which led to his formal retirement on April the 2nd of 2014.
Yeah, it was unfortunate all around because Inoue, for those who aren't too familiar with him, for newer fans and such, he was one of those guys that way back in the early days of New Japan, he was fighting amongst the Seikigun to counteract Liger's controlled terrorism unit back in the 2005-2006 era, and he was a very good junior heavyweight tag guy over there as well.
Yeah, he was pretty well regarded. I mean, and the crowd seemed to be into him. I mean, the crowd was into him in this match too.
Yeah, him and Kanemoto were a fairly successful team of their own there together for quite some time. He had his moments definitely between it. His success was mostly found within the tag team division, but yeah, it's just. And he had a lot of these back and forths with the Laughter 7 guys throughout all the way until close to the forced retirement in and of itself, because he was in a couple of tag matches against them, and normally he was kind of the one taking the fall in most of those.
Right, but I mean, even then, I mean, even around then, I mean, he was already in his late 30s when, mm-hmm. when this was happening. So, I mean, he was already hitting. I mean, he was going to be, you know, dad's territory.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Within a few years anyway.
Junior dad.
But yeah, junior dad. But, you know, again, unfortunately, he would suffer a career-ending neck injury on March the 4th of 2013 and then retire, formally retire on April the 2nd of 2014. Mm-hmm. I also just have a note here about the fact that Shibata was wearing just black Nike high tops.
Yep. That he was. What a shooter, man. Just, my God.
Yeah, and of course, now, you know, again, it's the, you know, difference between, you know, then and now. And now we, you know, here we are talking about, you know, in 2012, how he was, you know, this heel invader and you know, kind of chuckling at the fact he was wearing black Nike high tops. And now we look at Katsuyori Shibata in 2017, where he's almost a beloved figure in New Japan, and we're hoping that, you know, he'll be able to function as a normal human being at some point,
mm-hmm.
due to the injuries he's suffered. So, you know, again, funny how the times change, right?
Yep.
We then get to the top three matches of the card. The first of these, Kazuchika Okada, defending the Tokyo Dome challenge rights from winning G1 Climax earlier that year, and in a rematch against the man he faced in the finals, Machine Gun Carl Anderson.
Which, by the way, for anybody who's not as familiar with Carl Anderson's singles work, please get familiar with it. The man is an amazing pro wrestler all around, like, no matter what he does. Just...
Yeah, I have a note here saying that I honestly miss Anderson a lot of the times because of, I mean, he had like the theatricality of it too, like, you know, the when you say machine gun and then he does the, you know, cock the gun and, you know, shoots, you know, you hear the sound effects, mm-hmm. go with it.
Yeah,
you know, it was a great presence back then, even, you know, my feelings on guns notwithstanding, but you know, it was just an amazing, you know, theatrical presence. Mm-hmm. And then, again, this is during the time when Chaos was a hated heel unit. But mm-hmm. The crowd seemed to be pretty into Okada, though. I mean, I saw a lot of Rainmaker poses being thrown up when he came out.
He was starting to kind of fill that role of the crowd, a kind of this almost like rebellious type figure that they,
right. And keep in mind too that the beginning, remember how he started 2012 was interrupting Tanahashi's victory speech after beating Minoru Suzuki at Wrestle Kingdom 6 and being told to fuck off.
Yep,
and literally.
Yeah, with a bad
fuck off.
Yeah, with a bad pompadour and everything on top of it too. So it's a very interesting, and then
the next month winning the IWGP title. So I mean, within a matter of 9 months, it's unreal the turnaround he made.
Yeah, won the title, lost it, won the G1 at that point, and was defending the briefcase, which makes me kind of curious. Was this the first year that they officially started doing the contract defenses as an official thing, along with the briefcase gimmick?
I think you might be right. I think you might be right on that. I could be, I'm not honestly sure. I think you're right, though. It sounds about right.
It's just, but, yeah, and during my watch through that I was trying to do yesterday for the show, just to go over notes, this was, because I ended up watching it pretty late, this was unfortunately the point where my body's just like, yeah, you need to go to bed. But from what I can remember from that match back when we first saw it a few years ago, a lot of very good counter wrestling between the two in terms of the reversals that they were doing, the close falls and things like that. So, very enjoyable match, though, all around.
Yeah, I agree. It was a very good match. And, yeah, I really do miss Carl Anderson as a singles wrestler, too. I mean, he has some unrealized potential there. And, yeah, I mean, he has some real unrealized potential. I think it's a shame. It's kind of a shame he never actually held a New Japan singles title. I mean, he held several tag titles, of course. Yeah. Both with, you know, both not only with Doc Gallows, but with Giant Bernard.
Yeah, Bad Intentions.
Guns and Gallows, yeah. Yeah. But and keep in mind, too, we are a mere 5 months away from the formation of Bullet Club.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, I mean, and I think if you look at it, I think this was part of Anderson's motivation for forming Bullet Club, because I think he always felt like, you know, in character, that Okada kind of hosed him, you know, in some way, shape, or form. I mean, like heels will do. They always think that they got, you know, the best heels always feel justified that they're righting some wrong that was done on them, regardless of whether that's true or not. I mean, it was the same thing with Prince Devitt too. Like, he was tired. I mean, they were both tired of, you know, the Gaijin ceiling that had pretty much been in place ever since, you know, Brock Lesnar fucked Japan over.
And keep in mind, too, also with what we're talking about as well, Jeff mentioned one big thing being that this was a rematch out of their G1 Climax match, but we're not talking just any match. We're talking G1 Climax Finals.
I thought I mentioned the finals. I apologize.
No, I believe you did too. But the biggest point to make out of that is that prior to that, only one foreigner, Westerner, had made it to a G1 final, and that was Rick Rude. So Carl Anderson being number two in that list is a pretty astounding feat in and of itself. Granted,
that is true, and I neglected to mention that. So yes,
no worries, I got
you're right. But, I do have a note here though too, because I mentioned the theatricality of Anderson.
Yeah.
I will note here that something did not happen in this match that happens in every other Okada match, which is the camera did not pull back for the Rainmaker pose like it's supposed to.
Somebody screwed up the cue. No.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was, like, contractually obligated that they have to pull back for the Rainmaker pose.
It's like, look, Rainmaker pose gets put on, widen the camera shot, but it's not Okada doing it. Rainmaker pose, widen the camera. Did I stutter?
No, it was Okada that did it. And
I know. I'm just saying in general, basically.
Lordy. So I thought this was a great match. This is probably actually my second favorite match on the card overall.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, definitely.
The semi-main event was the still actually pretty bright and shiny IWGP Intercontinental title being defended by the then leader of Chaos, Shinsuke Nakamura, defending against Hirooki Goto. Now, we've been down this road a couple of times.
Yep.
But I'm just gonna say this was a very good match. I'm just gonna take this from the point of: do you remember when Hirooki Goto actually looked like he could be or actually accomplished something in New Japan?
Oh boy, we're really going that far back already. My God, that's sad.
It kind of is. Yes, I agree. It really is sad. But I mean, again, it goes to show you how things can change, you know, from from, you know, in the span of 5 years. I mean, now it just seems like, you know, Hiroki Goto is like just kind of a utility guy now. And before, he seemed like a genuine contender for, like, you know, for top, you know, for top belts and top, you know, tournament wins. I mean, he won, like, what, 2 or 3 New Japan Cups.
Yep.
And, yeah, just and nothing's ever come of it at all. I mean, he's never won the, after 8 attempts, he's never won the IWGP heavyweight title. And he had a brief run with the Intercontinental title, you know, winning it from and losing it back to Shinsuke Nakamura in 2015.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
it's one of those things. It was a very good match between them, but it's almost like looking back at past Goto now, knowing what present Goto's done, it's almost, again, we talk about it being night and day, but it couldn't be any more clearer with Hiroki Goto. Because this a guy that... And
plus, you know, Shinsuke Nakamura is no longer with the company either.
Yeah, there's that too, obviously.
I mean, we can look at some of the, you know, some of these names, like, you know, Wataru Inoue had to retire. Kazushi Sakuraba hasn't been around since early in 2016, I think.
Sakuraba does whatever Sakuraba wants to do at this point. We can't stop him.
Shibata is, you know, we don't know if he'll ever, you know, live a normal life ever again. Carl Anderson's gone, and Shinsuke Nakamura is gone as well.
Yeah.
Oh, and Prince Devitt and Low Ki.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Kota Ibushi only recently came back for after, you know, being away. You know, after leaving the company in somewhat spectacular fashion. Alex Kozlov is no longer there.
Yeah.
Shelley's no longer there.
Yeah.
And John, you know, Strongman. Who knows what the hell happened to him?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, again, 5 years is almost like an eternity in pro wrestling, and especially when you look at I mean New Japan. If you look at 2017, it is. If you look at how things have happened from the end of Wrestle Kingdom 10 in 2016, going into now, it's like you'd almost would swear it was a whole different company. And, you know, it's amazing going back how much is similar, but how much really has changed in New Japan. So, anyway, getting back on topic, the Shinsuke Nakamura defeating Hiroki Goto, retaining the white belt. I mean, this was a good, very good match. I really enjoyed it. I'd say probably my third favorite on the card.
Yeah, I think, honestly, the three big matches in this card, you can do the classifications between 1 through 3 for using them, and I think it'd be justified in some way, shape, or form. Though I think we all have a clear understanding of which one was the undisputed number one.
Yeah, and with good reason, and this was the main event of King of Pro Wrestling 2012, in which Hiroshi Tanahashi met Minoru Suzuki again. They had main evented Wrestle Kingdom 6 at the Tokyo Dome on January the 4th, 2012, and they're meeting again here in Tokyo Ryogoku Kokugikan on October the 8th of 2012. Hiroshi Tanahashi would retain the IWGP heavyweight title. Hitting high fly flow in nearly 29, you know, at nearly the 30-minute mark.
Mm-hmm. And just the crazy thing out of that entire match to me, not only was the fact that it was Suzuki working the arm, Tana working the leg, if I recall correctly, but the fact that there was just really one near fall the entire match, and they still kept that crowd at the palm of their hands from start to finish.
Yes, and
just insane.
Yeah, I also have a note here that, like, you know, there was a great bit with, you know, Tanahashi doing an abdominal stretch on Suzuki and then going into the air guitar on Suzuki, and Suzuki just has this look at Tanahashi, just looking like, you motherfucker.
It's not
like being used as an air guitar.
Keep in mind, we're going back into 2012, basically, and this is still Tanahashi at full peak, ace of the company, just have the best damn match every single night.
Yeah, I mean, there was no doubt who was the ace of the company at this point.
No, not at all.
And with good reason. But yeah, I mean, I mean, there's not just one particular bit in this match. I mean, it's just this is a match you have to experience as a whole. You can't dissect it. I don't think.
No, at least, I don't think so.
I don't feel qualified to dissect it. I just think if you look at it as the as the whole, it's just a fantastic pro wrestling match.
Mm-hmm. Definitely so.
I did notice that, at the very end, Tanahashi got handed, like, a bunch of trophies along with the title.
Yep.
Along with a talk from Kidani. I'm sure this has something to do tying in with King of Pro, with the King of Pro Wrestling game, if I had to hazard a guess, because I don't honestly recall what that was about. But at the end, we get an intrusion from Yujiro Takahashi.
Yep.
And he just ends up talking a bunch of shit. I have no idea what he said because it's obviously not translated. Do we know if that ever amounted to anything?
It was a match for the heavyweight championship, basically. He challenged him to basically put the title on the line, if I recall correctly.
But when and where?
I'm trying to think if it was at a later event in 2012 for New Japan. What would have come after that anyways? Power Struggle, I would be assuming?
If Power Struggle was a thing then, but I mean, I was just curious because I honestly had no recollection of that happening. So I just wondered if that would ever turn into a thing.
No, I do believe that it was him challenging him to a title match somewhere after the whole beat up Naito thing and whatnot. But whether that was done at a big show or anything like that, that much I do not know.
Okay, because I mean, we all know that now. Well, anyway, I mean, we'll discuss about what the defense means at King of Pro Wrestling here in a few minutes. But I know that again with Okada defending the the briefcase. So then, I mean, in our modern thinking, that means So next will be Tanahashi Okada at Wrestle Kingdom 7. But I don't know if that ever I guess it doesn't matter in the longer scheme of things. Yeah. But and I mean the fact that back then Yujiro had the cojones to challenge Tanahashi, and now
it did happen at Power Struggle actually. Power Struggle 2012 at Bodymaker Coliseum in Osaka, Japan. Hiroshi Tanahashi defeated Yujiro Takahashi in a 25-minute match to retain the title.
Okay, all right then. Well, there you have it. So, all right. But yeah, I mean, back then, this was when, Yujiro might have actually been considered to be a contender for the IWGP title.
Now it's not.
Yeah, now you can't. But getting back to Tanahashi and Suzuki, to say this was a fantastic match is a little bit of an understatement. This was the first New Japan match to get a 5-star rating from Dave Meltzer in over 15 years at the time.
Yep. Astounding.
And when you consider some of the matches that happened in New Japan in that 15-year period, that is, I mean, including, the very match that we discussed in the very first episode of Strong Style History between Kensuke Sasaki and Toshiaki Kawada.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider that, good grief.
It's one of those things, man, where it speaks volumes to the level of amazement that match ended up being.
And in fact, this also won Match of the Year in that year's Wrestling Observer Newsletter Reader's Poll.
Mm-hmm.
So that ended up. Now I don't know if it won like the Tokyo Sports Awards or anything. I didn't dig too far into that.
Yeah,
but, I mean, this is a pretty damn highly regarded match. And which means somehow they managed to surpass the match at Wrestle Kingdom 6.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, yeah, that Wrestle Kingdom match was fantastic in its own right. But yeah, they just, everything seemed to click for them in that match. There was really no wasted motion whatsoever.
There wasn't. And again, I can't dissect this match, move by move. Like some matches you can. Some matches you could say, point to certain sequences. This one, you really have to absorb it as a whole, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So, as for the legacy of King of Pro Wrestling, well, I mean, they're holding the 6th edition of it in a week's time. But it should be noted that At the time, Dave Meltzer called this show historically great.
Mm-hmm.
And it did win Best Major Show of the Year in the very same readers poll. And it also speaks volumes that King of Pro Wrestling now is become, you know, such an integral part of the New Japan calendar. I'm going to say it's possibly the third biggest show on the calendar. You know, going behind Wrestle Kingdom and the G1 Climax final. Possibly you could make an argument that the April show, which, you know, for a time was called Invasion Attack and now is known as Sakura Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
You could make an argument for that, that maybe this and the April show and King of Pro Wrestling are tied for the third biggest show of the year. One thing it should be noted is that King of Pro Wrestling, the mega card, has actually outlasted the card game that it was meant to promote.
Mm-hmm.
Because King of Pro Wrestling, the card game, ended, it ceased production, I believe, either late 2015 or early 2016.
Early 2016, I believe.
It was early 2016.
They had a Wrestle Kingdom 10 pack for it, so.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
That's so around the time it stopped.
It's outlasted the show that it was meant to promote. That speaks volumes of how this card goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, again, I don't think there's ever been a bad King of Pro Wrestling card in my memory.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. It's one of those things where it's like, dang, that's very, very crazy.
And now it's considered the last, you know, true mega show before Wrestle Kingdom. They do hold Power Struggle in November and then the World Tag League Finals in December. But mm-hmm. those aren't anywhere near as big as King of Pro Wrestling. Mm-hmm. So now it's considered the last mega card before Wrestle Kingdom on the calendar.
Yeah.
And now typically has the final IWGP heavyweight title defense of the calendar year before Wrestle Kingdom as well.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I'm just going to say that this particular show, there was not a bad match on the show at all.
Yeah, no. I think from top to bottom, that card was just a solid effort altogether between them. They paced everything well throughout it. And I think just having a first card like this set the standard for fans in Japan that go to these shows that, yeah, this is going to be an important show going forward where some big things could happen.
I think it's also speaks volumes of maybe some of the faith that the fans started putting into Bushiroad that they were actually going to be able to, you know, to handle business with New Japan,
mm-hmm.
you know, cause this was the show that added their, you know, this was Bushiroad's brand put on this show and mm-hmm. this is what they came up with.
Yeah, definitely. So it's, yeah.
And mind you, I mean, there is room for criticism of Bushiroad in New Japan. Don't get me wrong, but I mean, this was definitely, you know, as far as, you know, a leap of faith on the part of the New Japan fans. And I think that, you know, towards Bushiroad, I think Bushiroad actually delivered in this case.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree entirely with them.
So that's all I have to talk about King of Pro Wrestling 2012 as we come in the next week with King of Pro Wrestling 2017. It remains to be seen if it will be as high a quality show in practice as it is on paper, but I think so far the odds are looking pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Our producer today, of course, is my co-host, Chris Damasceno. Chris, do you want to add anything before we sign off today?
Nothing that comes to mind. Just thanks for listening again to Strong Style History. We're still, you know, gradually getting into the groove of doing these shows. We missed September just due to life commitments and things in between, but we've got some pretty good stuff coming up for you guys here in October, so, you know, stay
indeed.
Tuned with us.
Indeed, and in our next episode of Strong Style History, which will be episode 9, we're going to have a special guest on the show. We will have Brett, a.k.a. Bahu FMW, the godhead of all things FMW related on the internet, and has been for, you know, coming up on, you know, almost 20 years now. He's going to be joining us because the topic for our next show will be Atsushi Onita in New Japan Pro Wrestling in 1999. So that ought to be a doozy. So stay tuned for that. Chris, do you want to go ahead and plug yourself?
Just Twitter land. You can find me at Brazilian Fury. That's Brazilian with an S instead of a Z.
And you can find me at Strong Style Story without the E in style on Twitter. The regular Strong Style Story blog is at strongstylestory.tumblr.com. You can also listen to Strong Style Story, in which we talk about, you know, more ongoing modern things in New Japan. We just posted an episode a couple of days ago talking about the current King of Pro Wrestling card that's coming up, as well as some other things that are happening here and there within the realm of New Japan Pro Wrestling. Thanks for listening to this. Please stay tuned for other fine shows here on Place to Be Nation and the Pro Wrestling Only Board podcast feed, up to and including the Military Industrial Suplex, Letters from Center Stage, the Worldcast, and Throw the Years, a retrospective of the old days of Ring of Honor. On behalf of producer and co-host Chris Damasceno, my name is Jeffrey Wessel. Thanks for listening. We'll see you later in the month of October for episode 9 with our special guest, Bahu FMW. Talk to you then. Thank you for listening. Take care. Goodbye.